Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, scientists have long suspected that the rate of new infectious diseases could speed up. This is especially possible in developing countries where human and animal contact is increasing. Changes in the environment are moving many species of animals into new living spaces. Those movements, combined with more human contact with animals as people move deeper into forests, increases the chances of a virus-jumping species. This is what appears to have happened in China with the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. Like many infectious viruses introduced this way, the outbreak seems to have started with bats. Diseases that can jump from animals to humans are called zoonotic diseases. These diseases can be problematic because the human body is not designed to defend against this kind of invasion. The host animal species often shows no signs of disease. This is because the animal's body has already learned to deal with the virus. However, when such viruses or other disease-causing microorganisms jump from animals to humans, the effects can be deadly. Many scientists believe bats were the first carriers of the coronavirus that causes COVID-19. The animals have been linked to past outbreaks of coronaviruses in humans. Studies have shown that bats are natural hosts to many other viruses as well. One example is the Ebola virus, which caused deadly outbreaks in Western Africa. The Nipah virus, also carried by bats, has caused human outbreaks across South and Southeast Asia. Health experts say Nipah is serious enough to possibly cause a serious epidemic. The only other animals coming close to hosting as many viruses as bats are rodents. There are about 2,300 species of rodents, making up about 40% of all mammals. While rodents are believed to have more viruses as a group, bats host more viruses per species. Scientists believe the many types of species in both groups can create more possibilities for viruses. Some bats live in forests, while others are found in caves. Most eat insects such as beetles, moths, and mosquitoes. Some bats eat fruit, nectar, seeds, and pollen from flowers. Others eat small animals such as birds, fish, frogs, and lizards. A small number of bats feed on blood. Bats also provide many benefits to the environment. Some bats play important parts in plant pollination and spreading seeds. Bats can pollinate more than 500 species of plants, including avocados, bananas, dates, and mangoes. In Southeast Asia, durian, a highly valued fruit, can be effectively pollinated only by the dawn bat. In this way, bats are important economically for people. Insect-eating bats also serve to naturally control insect populations. These bats eat millions of insects at night, including some that cause severe damage to crops.
Greenland has become a point of interest for several countries, including the United States and China. This interest comes at a time when Greenland's government faces difficult decisions about the island's future. Those decisions include whether to approve large mining projects.
Greenland has large amounts of resources known as rare earth metals. These metals are used to create equipment for electric vehicles, combat aircraft, weapons systems, and many kinds of electronics. Greenland has what the U.S. Geological Survey calls the world's biggest undeveloped deposits of rare earth metals. Deposit is a term that means an amount of a resource, like a mineral, that exists in the ground. Most of Greenland, the world's largest island, is north of the Arctic Circle. But the island's ice covering and glaciers are shrinking. As a result, two Australia-based mining companies are racing for approval to dig. One of the companies is seeking financing in the United States. The other company is owned in part by a Chinese state-supported company. Each Greenland mine would cost about $500 million to develop, the companies say. Both plan to send mined material away for final processing. This processing often takes place in China. The two possible mines in Greenland are less than 16 kilometers from each other. They are at the southern end of the island, near a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
The debate over the possible mines has created a political crisis. In April, a general election will be held on the island of 56,000 people. Many Greenlanders are concerned about pollution, but they believe mining is important for developing their economy. In a 2013 public opinion study, just over half said they want raw materials to become the country's main source of money. The country may support either project, both projects, or neither project. But for those Greenlanders open to mining, the two possibilities come down to a choice between one mine that would not produce radioactive material and another that would. The first mine project would not involve nuclear material. It has won early environmental approval, but it needs investment and a processing plan. The second project has already spent more than $100 million preparing to mine. It has proven processing technology through its Chinese partner, and it won early political support from Greenland's government. But its plans include exporting uranium, a nuclear fuel. It recently ran into strong opposition from residents of the nearby town of Narsaq, among others.
Greenland's decision comes at a time when some Western countries are considering ways to break free of China in the production of an important resource. Rare earth metals have many uses, and last year China produced about 90% of them. said Toronto-based Adamas Intelligence. The only rare earth mine now operating in the United States is Mountain Pass in California. It is partly owned by a Chinese state-backed company that sends material mined in the United States to China for processing. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm John Russell. A proposed new avocado farm in Kenya would block the movements of elephants and other wildlife near a major national park. Local conservation activists say the farm would cut off the free movement of about 2,000 elephants living in the area around Amboseli National Park. The park is in southern Kenya near the border with Tanzania. The area is also home to other wildlife, including giraffes, zebras, and hippos. Kenyan agriculture company Kiliavo Fresh Limited has farms near Amboseli on nearly 70 hectares of land. The company is preparing to grow avocados, which have been rising in popularity around the world. Conservationists say the new farm and an electric fence around it will block the path of animals moving between Amboseli and other national parks nearby. The parks bring large numbers of tourists from around the world. Area tourism is mostly related to safaris. Tourism brought in about $1.6 billion in 2019 to the country. But avocado farming also brings in a lot of money. With ideal conditions for growing avocados, Kenya's export earnings rose 33% to about $127 million in the past year to October 2020. Kiliavo says it received government approval in mid-2020 to begin work on the farm after presenting an environmental report. Jeremiah Salash is a shareholder in Kiliavo and runs a farm for the company. Local people here all know the project, and they are happy because it's another source of employment and of making their land have value, Salash told Reuters news agency. However, Kenya's National Environment Management Agency ordered work halted last September. The agency said it wanted to withdraw the permission to build the new farm. Lawyers representing Kiliavo say the company has appealed that decision. The agency's acting director, Mamo Mamo, told Reuters it first decided to approve the farm plans because of support of the project by the Amboseli Ecosystem Trust. The trust is a coalition that includes community groups and government representatives. But the agency said it changed its position after that organization withdrew its approval. Conservationists say blocking the elephants could harm their population and the large tourism trade. Vicky Fishlock is a scientist working for the Amboseli Elephant Trust Group. "We can't just say to the elephants, would you mind not going that way because we have decided that we are going to do stuff here," she told Reuters. "Blocking the animals would surely kill the sanctuary as it depends on the animals migrating from Amboseli," added Samuel Kanki. He leads a group of 342 members
of the Maasai tribe who own more than 8,000 hectares where elephants live. Kanki said the elephants would seek other paths if they are blocked by farms like Kilievo's or others. This would result in massive human-wildlife conflicts. Lawyers for Kilievo say the farm sits about 17 kilometers away from Amboseli within an area approved for farming. The company also noted the project has been good for the local economy. It says the farm employs about 300 workers and established new technology in the area. The lawyers for Kilievo also told Reuters that those who are opposed to the project have mischaracterized it for their own gain. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We continue the story of America's 33rd president, Harry Truman. Truman was sometimes called an accidental president. He only became president because he was vice president when Franklin Roosevelt died in 1945. In the election of 1948, Truman ran for a full term. As we told you last week, many experts predicted he would lose. But voters chose him over the Republican Party candidate, Thomas E. Dewey, the governor of New York. Americans also elected a Congress with a majority from Truman's Democratic Party. The president might have expected a Congress led by his own party to support his policies, but that did not always happen. Time after time, Democrats from southern states joined in voting with conservative Republicans. Together, these lawmakers defeated some of Truman's most important proposals. One of the defeated bills was a proposal for health care insurance for every American. One of the major issues during Truman's second term was fear of communism. After World War II, Americans watched as one Eastern European nation after another became an ally of the Soviet Union. Soviet leader Joseph Stalin wanted to see communism spread around the world. And Americans watched as China became communist in 1949, as forces led by Mao Zedong defeated the Chinese nationalists after a civil war that had lasted more than 10 years. During this tense period, there were charges that communists held important jobs in the United States government. These fears, real or imagined, became known as the Red Scare.
Even if there were only one communist in the State Department, that would still be one communist too many.
A Republican senator from Wisconsin, Joseph McCarthy, led the search for communists in America. In speeches and congressional hearings, he accused hundreds of people of being communists or communist supporters. His targets included the State Department, the Army, and the entertainment industry. Senator McCarthy often had little evidence to support his accusations. Many of his charges would not have been accepted in a court of law. But the rules governing congressional hearings were different, so he was able to make his accusations freely. Many people lost their jobs after they were denounced as communists. Some had to use false names to get work. A few went to jail briefly for refusing to cooperate with McCarthy. The senator continued his anti-communist investigations for several years. By the early 1950s, however, more people began to question his methods. Critics said he violated democratic traditions. In 1954, the Senate finally voted to condemn his actions. McCarthy died 3 years later. There were problems caused by the fear of communists at home. But President Truman also had to deal with the threat of communism in other countries. He agreed to send American aid to Greece and Turkey. He also supported continuing the Marshall Plan. That was the huge economic aid program that helped rebuild Western Europe after World War II. Many historians say the Marshall Plan prevented Western Europe from becoming communist. The defense of Western Europe against Soviet communism led Truman to support the creation of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. NATO began in 1949 with the United States, Britain, Canada, France, and eight other nations. The treaty that created NATO stated that a military attack on any member would be considered an attack on all of them. Truman named General Dwight Eisenhower to command the new organization. General Eisenhower had been supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe in World War II. In his swearing-in speech in 1949, Truman urged the United States to lend money to other countries to aid their development. He also wanted to share American science and technology. In 1951, the president asked Congress to establish a new foreign aid program. The aid would go to countries threatened by communist forces in Europe, the Middle East, North Africa, East Asia, South Asia, and Latin America. Truman believed the United States would be stronger if its allies were stronger. President Truman believed that many of the world's problems could be settled by means other than military force. But he supported and used military power throughout his presidency. On June 25, 1950, forces from North Korea invaded South Korea. 2 days later, the United Nations Security Council approved a resolution urging UN members to help South Korea resist the invasion. At first, President Truman agreed to send American planes and ships. Later, he agreed to send American ground forces. The president knew his decision could start World War III if the Soviet Union entered the war on the side of communist North Korea. Yet he felt the United States had to act. Later, he said it was the most difficult decision he made as president. Truman named Army General Douglas MacArthur to command all United Nations forces in South Korea. Most of the fighting in the Korean War took place along the geographic line known as the 38th parallel. This line formed the border between North and South Korea. Many victories on the battlefield were only temporary. One side would capture a hill, then the other side would recapture it. In September of 1950, MacArthur led the UN land and sea attack at Incheon, pushing the North Koreans back across the border. There was hope that the war could end by Christmas, December 25th. In late November, however, troops from China joined the North Koreans. Thousands of Chinese soldiers helped push the UN troops south. General MacArthur wanted to attack Chinese bases in Manchuria. President Truman said no. He did not want the fighting to spread beyond the Korean Peninsula. Again, he feared that such a decision could start another world war. MacArthur strongly believed he could end the war quickly by extending it to the Chinese mainland. He publicly denounced Truman's policy, saying, "There is no substitute for victory." Truman felt that the general left him no choice. In April of 1951, he dismissed MacArthur.
"It was with the deepest personal regret that I found myself compelled to take this action. General MacArthur is one of our greatest military commanders, but the cause of world peace is much more important than any individual."
In the United States, military leaders are expected to obey their commander-in-chief, the president. While some Americans approved of the general's dismissal, many others supported MacArthur. Millions greeted him when he returned to the United States. There were huge parades in his honor in San Francisco and New York. In fact, few leaders in the 20th century could boast the support MacArthur had. Almost 7 million people attended the ticker tape parade given to him by New York City. And that almost doubled the size of the one given to another returning World War II hero, General Dwight Eisenhower. MacArthur gave his farewell speech to a joint session of Congress on April 19, 1951.
"I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plain at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye."
On the Korean Peninsula, the war continued. Ceasefire talks began in July of 1951, but the conflict would last for another 2 years until a truce was declared. The Korean War Armistice Agreement was signed on July 27, 1953.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.